Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the films Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, Bumblebee, Second Act, and Welcome to Marwen. I'm also going to be talking about the news, Trailer Park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Urban Legend and Urban Legend's final cut new on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news is a couple rest in pieces we have, a couple celebrity deaths. The first one was Penny Marshall died this week at the age of 75 from complications with diabetes. I have always been a big Penny Marshall fan. Going all the way back to, of course, Laverne and Shirley, I was a kid of the 70s and the 80s, so I grew up watching Laverne and Shirley. She was a great comedic actor. She had a great timing and great chemistry with Cindy Williams. And with any sort of duo, you always have some tensions here and there. But she had such a great start as an actress and wasn't sort of like that leading lady material. She was a little more brash. She was a little more edgy. And that wasn't something that played terribly well for leading ladies, especially back in the 70s and 80s. But then after being on Laverne and Shirley, she's made her way as a fantastic director. Now, I never saw Jumpin' Jack Flash. That was like, her first movie she did. And that one, I think she inherited. She kind of stepped in after a director left, but she had some really fantastic films. I mean, stuff like Big. Big is a brilliant movie. Big is the movie that put Tom Hanks on the map as an actor, not as a guy who was in movies, but as somebody who you could take seriously as an actor. I mean, nowadays you say Tom Hanks and everyone goes, oh, he's a great actor. Back in the 80s, people didn't realize that. It was Penny Marshall that gave him that opportunity. But really my favorite one of hers was Awakenings, which is a very subtly directed but touching and beautiful movie. She was one of those celebrities who had a double career and never like put herself in the movie necessarily. I mean, I think she showed up a couple times in front of the camera, but she became a director and she was a brilliant director. She had certainly left an impact on the entertainment world and movies themselves. Also, rest in peace to Donald Moffat. He just died at age 87. Now, most people don't know who that is. He's a character actor, but he's in one of my favorite movies of all time, which is The Thing, the John Carpenter movie. He has one of the best lines, not the best line, but one of the best lines in the film. He plays Gary, who's the captain, the guy who runs the outpost. He's also recognizable in tons of other movies. I think he was like the president in one of the, I think, Clear and Present Danger, the one with Harrison Ford. And he was also in the original Popeye movie from 1980. He played the tax collector. He showed up in a ton of different movies. He was in a Steve Martin movie. What movie it was? He played Steve Martin's dad where he sings him Three Coins in a Fountain or something like that. Or he sings True Allure, Allure Adam. He showed up in so many different things and he had done stuff on stage and on screen. But of course, I'll always remember him for John Carpenter's The Thing. So he died at age 87 this week. The last piece of news I want to hit is less depressing. You know, it's not about the death of celebrities. This one's just sort of like a piece of news that came out. The first look at Will Smith as the genie in the new Aladdin remake, the live action, quote unquote, live action version. Cause these movies aren't really live action. Jungle Book wasn't a live action movie. It was mostly CGI. The Lion King doesn't look like there's a shred of actual photography in there. It's all done in a computer, but we're going to call it live action. But Will Smith is the genie. First of all, you're stepping into Robin Williams' shoes. And that is a tough act to fill. And Will Smith fancies himself a comedian. He's really not. He's a rapper. He's a musician artist. He plays a great leading man. His shtick isn't as witty as Robin Williams was. So you're set up for failure covering that. And then you look at this. He looks terrible. The greatest response that I've heard from somebody, and I don't know who said it, was on Twitter. And I know a lot of people actually said it. There was a movie called Kazam with Shaquille O'Neal playing a genie, but a lot of people remember that movie as Shazam, starring Sinbad as a genie. That movie never existed. And somebody pointed out that this look that Will Smith has, it's like they said, we're going to make that movie exist, only it happens now. And this is our own version of Shazam Kazam with Will Smith as a genie. It looks terrible. I don't know. So much hinged on Robin Williams' performance in Aladdin that I cannot see Will Smith making this movie. This looks like it's going to be a live action, quote unquote, live action version of Shark Tale, which was terrible. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit opens on April 12th, and that is the new version of Hellboy.
We're the line in the sand. We fight against the forces of darkness.
This is the Earth.
We're expecting a sign that says secret headquarters.
You made me a damn weapon. I just wanted to help you become the best you.
Some dads get their kids Legos.
I thought we were supposed to be fighting monsters, not working with them.
Now, I am a huge fan of Guillermo del Toro. I think his visionary style is brilliant. Not everything he's done I've loved. I mean, there's, especially his earlier stuff. I actually think his earlier stuff's kind of rough. I wasn't a huge fan of his Mexican stuff. I mean, it's okay, the Spanish language stuff that he did. And I wasn't a huge fan of Mimic. Even the Blade movie he did wasn't, I think he did Blade 2. That was not that good either. I mean, it was okay. It was passable. But he really kind of came into his own when they kind of like gave him more free reign, sort of post Pan's Labyrinth. And so, you know, Hellboy, the original Hellboy, I thought was really good. I thought the Hellboy, the Golden Army, was actually even better. I liked the style he did. What's interesting with this one, it looks so similar to the original Hellboy movies that I'm going to have trouble sort of spreading them apart in my head. It doesn't look like it's doing its own version of it. It almost looks like it might be a sequel or exist in that same universe. That's, I think, the biggest struggle I'm going to have with it. The guy playing Hellboy, I think, is fine. But, you know, I mean, Ron Perlman was perfect for the role, but this guy doing it is fine. But I don't know. The only thing, that's my big worry, is that it's not differentiating itself enough from the look of the other films. But we'll see. I'll check it out in April, that's for sure. The other one I want to talk about is Men in Black International, which opens on June 14th.
You are the best kept secret in the universe. And I found you.
Which makes me perfect for this job.
You really think a black suit is going to solve all your problems?
We are a rumor. Recognizable only as deja vu and dismissed just as quickly.
Time to prove yourself, Agent M.
This is the attempt to reboot the Men in Black series without Will Smith, because he's busy being a genie in what looks like one of the most uneven Disney remakes we're going to see in a while. But Men in Black International stars Tessa Thompson as, of course, this young Spitfire who's trying to get into the Men in Black. You've also got Chris Hemsworth kind of playing the Cad. I don't know. This series is such a 90s series, even though the only the first one actually, I think, came out in the 90s. The rest came out in 2000. I don't know if it's going to click. I mean, it almost seems like it's out of its own time. It feels like you're dealing with something that's not old enough to really be nostalgic yet, but not new enough to really have any sort of appeal. It looks kind of like a been there, done that kind of movie. So who knows? I mean, I got to see more about the plot and the story. But if it's just, ha ha ha, we're making Men in Black jokes and look, aliens and CGI, we've had that. And I think we might run into the same problem we had with the Independence Day sequel, which all the stuff that you saw that was breathtaking in the original Independence Day movie, you saw that all the time now because the effects have gotten better and budgets have gotten bigger. So, you know, we'll see. This one, I'm not quite sold on this one. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Second Act and Welcome to Marwen. to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Second Act. Jennifer Lopez plays a woman with no college education who spoofs a resume and ends up as a consultant in a high-class cosmetics company.
Arthur got his MBA from Duke. He's the best man for the job.
No, sir. I am.
I just wish we lived in a world where street smarts equal book smarts.
Somebody call for you. Something about a job interview?
Oh my God, Franklin and Clark?
Your resume interests me. Wharton Business School?
I'm sorry, what?
I gave you a completely new identity.
A lie got you in the door.
But you got the job, baby.
It's not easy getting a job for a woman your age.
Watch me.
This was one of those movies. There's always a movie at the end of the year that I am dreading. That I'm just like, oh God, I gotta go see this movie. And I was just, I didn't want to see this because I was coming near the end of the year, and usually that spread between Christmas and New Year's, I get to see everything early enough, either through screenings or through screeners that are sent to me for award consideration, that there's usually a week or two that I don't actually have to go to the theater. And as much as I love movies, it's nice to have a break now and then. It's nice to not go see movies every single night of the week. So I always look forward to that break. So like that, those last couple movies that I got to see, it's just a little bit trying on my patience. But I went to go see Second Act, and you know what I have to say? I'm gonna not bury the lead here. I thought it was a fine little movie. I didn't think it was a great movie, but I was like, I don't have any major problems with it. I mean, there's issues with the film. Part of it is, it's meant to be this Jennifer Lopez going into the working world and proving herself, and we've seen that story before a bunch of times. In fact, we saw it, I think it was earlier this year with I Feel Pretty, that awful movie with Amy Schumer, where and with, I think it was a cosmetics company that she worked for, where she was the brash, unfit girl who comes into the thing and turns it all upside down. Working Girl, we saw that with Working Girl in the 80s. You know, even Trading Places back in 1984, was that when that came out? With Eddie Murphy kind of doing the street smarts versus book smarts kind of character. You know, this is not a new film. This is not a new story. And Jennifer Lopez sort of just takes on that role. She's not annoying. She's not awful in this movie. And if you look at her history, like just recent movies, there was this little small little movie she did, I think with Viola Davis, where there was sort of like these women going for revenge. But before that, she had stuff like The Boy Next Door, and that was awful. And she just had a run of really terrible movies, sort of in the early teens of the 2000s. So she's kind of back. It is a little absurd because at one point they say, oh, it's tough when you're 40. And I'm like, oh, honey, you're not 40. You were 40 about 8 or 9 years ago. You're pushing 50, lady. But, you know, of course they have to do that. Women are always cast younger. And of course she's had all the work done. But this is probably the best Jennifer Lopez movie that she's done in a decade. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's great. The other problem with it is it tells a story, and it's a story, like I said, it's that working girl story that you're sort of expecting. And then it takes this weird little side path and it becomes a totally different movie. I mean, the same characters are in it, and it's sort of like the heart tone is still there, but there's this huge sort of twist that goes on in like the second act that I was like, whoa, it's like there were two different movies that kind of got merged into one. And then to a certain degree, it plays out okay, but it doesn't quite fit. Now, it's not a romantic comedy. It's not about her falling in love. It has a feel of a rom-com. It's just not a rom-com. And that's okay. Not everything needs to be a rom-com. But the movie also, the other thing, a weird thing it does is, I don't know when this movie takes place, because they have a scene where they go to a Christmas, they literally are, hey, we're going to the Christmas party. And it's like, it's fall. I mean, their leaves are falling from the trees, and there's other shots where there's green trees. And I'm like, what season is this taking place in? I think they added some of the Christmas elements later to make it tie in closer to Christmas, even though it's not really a Christmas movie. It just kind of has a little bit of that taking place. Overall, I thought this was perfectly fine. It's not a great movie. I've seen way worse Jennifer Lopez films, but it's not bad. It's if you watch the trailer and you're interested in it, go see it. You'll probably enjoy it. If you watch the trailer and you hate it and don't want to see it, don't go see it, because you're going to get exactly what the trailer promises. So in the end, I'm going to have to say that Second Act kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie Welcome to Marwen. Steve Carell plays a man who lost his memory in an attack and builds tiny dolls to bring it back.
I heard what happened to you.
Five of them jumped him. It's a miracle he survived.
You taking your meds?
I got beaten within an inch of my life for no reason.
One foot in front of the other. You got it, Mark.
Embrace the pain.
But I've created a world where I can heal.
What is all of this?
Welcome to Marwen. It's my art installation.
This is based on a documentary called Marwen Call, which I actually have a copy lying around somewhere. I've never watched it. I hear it's a great documentary. It's a true story about a guy who was beaten up and gets brain damage, and it's a therapy thing, building these like models and sort of trying to conceptualize his world and find a way to recover from PTSD and the problems that he faces. But this is then directed by Robert Zemeckis, who is well known for being kind of putting style over substance in his movies. I didn't see this. Now, it's not that they didn't screen it. I'm actually not giving a rating for this movie because I can't give it a preemptive suck because they did screen it. It's just they screened it on the same night as Aquaman. So I had to go see Aquaman. So I'm not going to give it a rating because I don't think it's fair for me personally to rate it, but it is getting reviews out there and the reviews are brutal. Now, I expected that to happen because a couple weeks ago, people in some of these critic organizations were like, hey, are we going to get a screener for this before we can do our nominations? And then the people were looking at the awards slate. You can go to anybody's. And I talked about this with The Mule last week. Warner Brothers, it wasn't on their awards slate for that year. And I think this is a Universal movie. It's not on the award for your consideration page. Every year, each studio puts together a page that says these are the movies that we want you to consider for awards. Welcome to Marwen was nowhere to be seen on that. And they didn't send out screeners for it. And that's a bad sign, especially this time of year for a Steve Carell movie that just reeks of award bait. Well, and then when the movie reviews started coming out, it's pretty clear why it's getting raked over the coals. It's not getting a good reaction from critics. If you don't believe critics, that's fine. I've not seen it. But I do want to share a quote. Somebody quoted, this comes from Slash Film, and the reviewer is Chris Evangelista. I saw this quoted on somebody's page, and I said, this is just, it's one of those things where he hated this movie. And how he describes it is, he talks about taking the original documentary, and they, quote, slather it with rancid mayo, topped with a urinal cake garnish. It is a travesty, an act of vandalism. Going from Marwen Call to Welcome to Marwen feels tantamount to disrespecting something sacrosanct, as if someone erected a clown dunking booth in the middle of a church during a funeral for your father. End quote. There are a ton of reviews out there like this that are just heaping unpraise on this movie. I'm sure from a technical level it's gorgeous. And I'm sure Steve Carell throws down acting. I just don't know how good this movie is. They screened it, so I can't give it a preemptive suck, but it does get a vote of no confidence from me. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Aquaman and Bumblebee. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with movie reviews and hit the big one that's probably going to be the biggest one over Christmas, and that is Aquaman. A metahuman with the power of the ocean must fight to take his rightful place on the throne of Atlantis.
My parents made me what I am. I am the protector of the deep.
In this trident resides the power of Atlantis. In the wrong hands, it would bring destruction. But in the hands of the true heir, it would unite above and below.
The time has come for Atlantis to rise again.
We must stop him.
The war is coming to the surface, whether you like it or not.
If you would have told me 10 years ago that the Batman and Superman movies are leaving everybody cold, and it's Wonder Woman and Aquaman who are propping up the DC franchise, I would have said you were bonkers. But that is exactly what's happening here. Wonder Woman was a huge hit, and now Aquaman is primed to be a huge hit, and with good reason. What happened with the DC characters is you had the Dark Knight movies, the ones that Christopher Nolan did, and there was really only one great movie, and that was The Dark Knight. Batman Begins was okay, had some problems. The Dark Knight Returns was kind of a mess. It's fun, but it also has its problems. By the time Avengers hit and everyone realized, holy cow, these movies can do really, really well, The Dark Knight Rises was coming out and they had wrapped that franchise up and then they were already in production of a Superman movie. So they ended up doing Man of Steel, which was the dreary, heavy, Nolanverse version of Superman. I actually got in an argument with this guy who's a critic and an entertainment reporter, and I was criticizing Nolan for his influence on Man of Steel. And he was like, no, it was not Nolan who did it. I go, yeah, it was his company, Syncope, that did it. And it was him who helped come up with the story. Now, maybe he didn't write the script and maybe he didn't direct it, but he certainly spearheaded the vision. And that was the dark, gritty, realistic Dark Knight version of Superman. And Man of Steel did okay with Zack Snyder at the helm. And I think Zack Snyder can do some good movies. Like, I thought he did The Watchmen was a great movie. But Man of Steel wasn't that great. And then they suddenly said, well, we want our own Avengers. So they decided to start speed ramping into that. And they did Batman versus Superman, which I actually thought was okay. Because that dark grittiness works with Batman. But that got them trying to do a Justice League movie. And then when they ended up doing Justice League, everyone wanted what Wonder Woman had. And then there was also that internal thing where Zack Snyder's daughter committed suicide, which was horrible. And then they passed it on to Joss Whedon, and they're very different directors, and he kind of had a mess of a Justice League movie. Part of it is they put all their eggs in one basket, making everything in the DC universe Zack Snyder, with the exception of David Ayer's Suicide Squad, which is an awful movie in itself, even though it did well. What ended up happening is when Wonder Woman came out, everyone was like, no, this is what we want. We want more of this. We want more of optimism and brightness and colorful and good old-fashioned heroes that we know from the comics, not that dark brooding garbage. And then they tried to change and course-correct Justice League, which was just kind of a mess. And now we've got Aquaman. And one of the best things that Warner Brothers did is they said, okay, no, we're not going to release any other superhero movies in 2018. Let everybody forget that Justice League happened, and we're going to do Aquaman. And Aquaman is very much like Wonder Woman in the sense that it's optimistic, it's bright, it's colorful, it's more fun, it's not dark and brooding. If you watch Aquaman, it is a feast for the eyes. It is awesome to watch. They don't do a whole lot of underwater stuff in movies because the expense is so high and it looks so goofy when it's done with special effects, but this thing worked, and they have like brightly colored sets, and the design is really different and interesting. We've really never seen anything like this, and that really helps this film. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of story elements and plot elements that we've seen before in everything from Black Panther to Iron Man, but that's okay. These are all just sort of formulaic elements to it. The key is to just be able to tell that story, and it's a good, solid adventure movie. And, you know, Jason Momoa does a good job. He's not just because he's super sexy. He almost looks as good as I do without my shirt on. Also, as much as Jason Momoa is just a big dude who looks like he could crush anybody, he still has a warmth and friendliness to him. He's accessible, and that helps make the movie work. It's nice to see an Aquaman that can kick somebody's butt nowadays instead of just that Ken doll that we had in the Super Friends. But this is a fun movie. It's got elements of adventure and it's silly and it's at times dumb, but that's okay. It's an exciting film and it has great special effects. It's got like sea monsters and sharks with laser beams and a lot of really cool stuff in this movie. It's a fun movie and it is 100% out of the box from the gritty, dark, brooding Batman versus Superman Dark Knight element. And I'm glad they're getting away from it. Unfortunately, now they have to sort of back end everything together and sort of explain where everybody is. And they kind of just ignore a lot of stuff. They mention it really quickly about Justice League. And then we're just moving on. And that's, I think, what Warner Brothers is doing. They're just moving on, which is kind of how the comic books worked. And that's okay. I'm going to have to say Aquaman, that's a blast of a film. Totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent! Yay!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Bumblebee really quick. In 1987, a misfit teenager discovers her new junker car is really a transforming robot from outer space.
Oh my god. What are you?
So you have no idea where he came from?
No idea.
There's a war raging on our planet. If this criminal isn't found, that war may find its way here.
Is there anyone that can help you? Do you have a family? Oh, me.
The Transformers movies have had diminishing returns. The first one was fine. It wasn't great. It had all the problems that a Michael Bay movie has. He's unable to focus on the plot. It turns into this big beer commercial. The other thing about the Transformer movies is there's a lot of stuff that's arguably not for little kids. I mean, there's like pot jokes in either the first or second movie where the mom's eating brownies that are pot-laced brownies that aren't appropriate for little kids. They have that racist robot that got really criticized in the second movie. It has a lot of sexual references that are inappropriate for little kids. I mean, there's a whole section in, I think, the fourth one where they're talking about age of consent. And I'm like, is this really something that we need to do in a kid's movie? The Michael Bay movies are long and they're like almost 3 hours and they're bombastic and they're loud and they're nonsensical and the characters are terrible and they're written like a hyperactive 5-year-old that had too many espressos. These films are terrible and they have had diminishing returns and they make less sense as you go on. So they're sort of rebooting it and saying, okay, we're just going to do this nice little movie that's a one-off and it works. And as much as it is a film set in 1987, it also draws from the movies of the 80s. I mean, it feels a lot like E.T., only instead of a little kid with his gray alien, you have this teenage girl whose car turns into a robot. It works, and part of it's grounded with Hailee Steinfeld as the actress, and she's fantastic. She's from True Grit, and she really showed her acting chops in that movie. She's had some other stuff, like Edge of 17 she was good in. She really gives a heart to the movie, and you get into the relationship between her and the robot, and that really is sweet and warm and charming. And it's completely appropriate for little kids to watch, too. It still has robots blowing things up. It still has the Decepticons coming in and fighting Bumblebee, and it looks really cool. But at its heart, it's this boy and his dog kind of story, which we had a lot in the 80s. And that's what it's drawing from. I it's not going to make $1 billion, and that's unfortunate. It's not going to be as big of a hit as the other Transformer movies, but it's a better movie. It's literally the best Transformer movie I've seen, just because it's coherent and it makes sense and it's well put together. I've been saying for years, hand off the Transformer series to somebody else. Let somebody else direct it so it doesn't all drip in that Michael Bay beer commercial directing style. I hope that this is a big enough hit that they continue to do this. So I just hope that they don't say, oh, Michael Bay, you've made 5 of these. Come on and make another one. You've defined your entire career as making these crappy movies that tend to make money, but they're crap. Move on and do something different. So yeah, Bumblebee, great little film. Totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review Mary Poppins Returns, talk about the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Urban Legend and Urban Legend's final cut. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with our final movie review, which is Mary Poppins Returns. The magical nanny returns to reignite the spirit of imagination in the Banks children and their children.
I was blowing the kite and I got called to the nanny!
Mary
Poppins! You came back!
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
What brings you here after all this time?
Same thing that brought me the first time. I've come to look after the Banks children.
Us?
Oh, yes, you too.
It's been more than 50 years since the first Mary Poppins came out. And if Disney does anything well in the last 20 years, it's making sequels of their original material. So it took them a while to get onto the Mary Poppins train, but I think a lot of that had to do with getting far enough away from the original that it didn't seem cheap. And this is as much a homage to the original Mary Poppins as it is a sequel to it. Emily Blunt, first of all, is fantastic in this movie. If there is an actress who deserves many accolades this year, it is Emily Blunt, because not only does she give a spot-on Julie Andrews performance as Mary Poppins, she also becomes part of that role. She doesn't just do a caricature, and I liken it to when Meryl Streep was Julia Childs or Margaret Thatcher. Both of those characters, very easy to fall into caricature. Oh, very easy to be old Julia Childs like this. It's very easy to play Margaret Thatcher like this. It's very easy to just turn into a joke. It's like playing Nixon. So many people imitate that it's hard to become that character, and Emily Blunt does. The other thing that this movie does is it has all of the elements that you'd expect from a Mary Poppins movie. Now, Mary Poppins, I'll go out and say, the first one's not my favorite Disney movie. It's a sweet film. It runs a little long, and the story gets a little silly at times, but it's a charming film, and all those elements blend into this one. You have some fun little music moments. You have the animation. Of course, they go into these animated worlds, and instead of just all going CGI, they use either ink and paint cell animation or a tribute to that that's probably done in a computer, but it still has that look of ink and paint. And, you know, like the penguins, the dancing penguins from the original, they're back, and that makes this movie work. There's a couple things in the music and the choreography that's a little silly, and the songs aren't as good or memorable as the original, but boy, if this one isn't just a charming little movie. It's a fun little family film, and it's a movie that I think people can watch in the future and not feel like it's trampling on the memory of the original Mary Poppins. So I'm going to have to say that Mary Poppins Returns totally rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Last week's box office, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse topped the box office with $35 million, which is great for an animated film. And it's actually, I think, the highest animated December release, if I'm not mistaken. The Mule came in second with $17.5 million. Not bad for a movie that they didn't screen and was clearly not up for any award consideration at all. Mortal Engines tanked, no pun intended. Less than $8 million. And Once Upon a Deadpool did not do terribly well. It was outside of the top 10 with less than $3 million. But then again, it's on DVD and it's just an alternate take. It's sort of like when they did an alternate take version of Anchorman. So, I mean, you're going to see a lot of those move down the list because this week, Aquaman's the big one. But, you know, I think Bumblebee can squeak out some performance. You got all week. And like Mary Poppins has like a 7-day weekend because it opened on Tuesday night. And it goes all the way through Christmas is when they're going to really rack up all the totals. So yeah, this is going to be a huge money-making weekend for all of Hollywood, and I think there's something out there for everybody, really, in this box office. There's a lot of superhero stuff. There's competition in the superhero and action categories, but there's something out there for everyone. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Two movies I want to talk about that are on Blu-ray for the first time. And they're a couple weeks late on this one, and my apologies on that. I just get backed up with all these films, and I got to be able to talk about all of them as much as I can. So the first one is Urban Legend. A serial killer strikes at a university, offing the victims in the tradition of infamous urban legends.
They are the legends we've all heard.
Gang members drive around at night with their headlights off, and when someone goes to flash from their high beams to warn them, they kill them.
But just because it never happened doesn't mean it never will.
The decapitated body was found in her car.
I knew I should have gone to NYU. What if there is a lunatic on campus?
What is he gonna do next, huh? Maybe put spider eggs in bubble gum?
The idea of an urban legend serial killer.
This movie came out back in 1998, and it was around the time when like Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven were trying to reboot the horror slasher franchise, and they had stuff like I Know What You Did Last Summer and the Scream movies, and this was another attempt for it. It didn't really take off as much as like the Scream series did, but this one actually is kind of a fun little late 90s thriller slasher. It's got a ludicrous bad guy outfit. You know, like, you know, Jason has his hockey mask, Michael Myers has his William Shatner mask. In this one, the killer has a big winter coat with a big hood, which is a little bit silly because nobody else has ever dressed that much in these movies. It's somewhere up in New England, but it's not like snowing all the time. I don't know. It's a silly outfit for the killer to wear, but they have to do that. It has a great cast, like Jared Leto's in this and Alicia Witt. I mean, Tara Reid's in it, like an early Tara Reid before she went completely off the rails and was doing Sharknado movies. I mean, it does reek of the 90s and sort of that Kevin Williamson breed of actors, but it's a fun little movie. I hadn't seen it in years, probably about almost 20 years because it was the 20-year anniversary. And I still think it's kind of cool. It's also loaded with special features. I mean, it's a double disc set as the collector's edition. It has a new audio commentary, a couple, and then the original audio commentary. But the second disc has like a feature-length documentary on making it and a whole bunch of interviews and behind-the-scenes footage and archive things as well. I mean, this thing's loaded to bear with special features. So if you're at all a fan of these sort of mid to late 90s horror slasher films, this is worth getting. Even if you don't like the movie that much, there's so much extra content on this that it's one of those packaged DVDs. And it's from Scream Factory. They're putting together some great content in terms of additional content and not just the movie. Because nowadays, when it comes to physical media, that's why people are buying it. Not just for the movie, because you can always stream a movie. But finding the 10, 12 hours of additional viewing pleasure on a disc, it's worth it to pick one of these up. So I'm going to have to say that the Urban Legends Collector's Edition totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish off with the last Urban Legend movies, and that is Urban Legends Final Cut, another new to Blu-ray. A girl working at a film school faces a killer whose personal style is to kill with the inspiration from urban legends.
Cut! She's no Jamie Lee Curtis, right?
Urban Legends, scene 6, take 2.
The movie is about a serial killer whose murders are all based on urban legends.
That's pretty cool.
It's an urban legend.
No.
It's a tradition. During finals week, at the stroke of midnight, everyone screams.
Someone is turning legends.
But at the same time, a co-ed is brutally attacked.
Into reality.
As fun and as exciting and as kind of cool as the late 90s urban legend is, the 2000 era Urban Legends Final Cut is really terrible. The cast isn't nearly as good. I mean, you've got some interesting people in it who ended up going places. Eva Mendes is in it. You also have Jennifer Morrison, who of course went on to be on House and other things. She's pretty young in this movie. The problem with this one is it's not just rehashing the story, because you do that in slasher movies and that's okay. But this one, it's at a film school, and any movie about a film school or about film students tends to be overly pretentious, and this one is. And the director thinks he's doing Hitchcock. I mean, he even references how much the characters are doing Hitchcock, and then he's doing Hitchcock stuff. And it's very hard to do Hitchcock without looking like you're just being an imitator. I mean, like, Brian De Palma never lived down being an imitator of Hitchcock, even when he wasn't. And this guy who directed Urban Legends Final Cut, it just turns into a pretentious, nonsensical movie that also is not a very well-written story. So there's a couple decent stuff on here in terms of special features. There's new interviews with some of the actors and some of the people involved with it. There's the audio commentary and deleted scenes, making a featurette, you know, gag reel and that sort of thing. So it has some decent extra content, but it's not a great movie. So I'm going to have to say that Urban Legends Final Cut kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Other movies that are out on DVD and Blu-ray this week include Venom, The Predator, The House with a Clock in Its Walls, A Simple Favor, Fahrenheit 11.9, Schindler's List 4K, Deep Throat, finally actually on Blu-ray, I guess, Starman, the Collector's Edition, I'll talk more about that next week, and Assassination Nation. And that is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the movies Vice, Destroyer, and Stand and Ollie. Until then, have a fat time at the movies. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.